Richard Norton Taylor reveals the secrets of his 40-year career as a journalist covering the world of spies and their masters in Whitehall. In his book, The State of Secrecy, Richard successfully campaigns against official secrecy, gaining a reputation inside the Whitehall establishment and the outside world alike for his relentless determination to expose wrongdoing and incompetence, described once as a long-term thorn in the side of the intelligence establishment. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Richard Norton Taylor himself. Richard, good morning to you.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. Being described after your long career with The Guardian as your decision not to go into the intelligence service was journalism's gain, quote unquote.
Well, it was quite funny, really, because I got a pretty bad degree, like a lot of other people who were invited, as I was, in the mid-60s to join the MI6, Britain's Secret Intelligence Service. And I got a pretty bad degree, but I thought, no, I prefer to go on the other side of things. I prefer to be a journalist rather than reveal secrets rather than spy and keep secrets. And I started off, interestingly, in Brussels. My first day in the Guardian staff was the 1st of January 1973, which people may remember as the day we actually joined what we then called the Common Market or European Community.
And Brussels at that time was something of a hot spot for spying and quote unquote intelligence.
Well, I think it probably still is in a sense because NATO headquarters are there too, of course. Yes, what was good and what made it a paradise for young budding journalists like me was that the British editors and MPs and ministers indeed did not know what these sort of weird institutions were, the European Commission and so on. There were very few journalists, British journalists, based in Brussels. So as the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who later on in, I think, the 90s was the Daily Telegraph's European correspondent, you could actually make things up. And he, as he said, he later admitted a curious sense of power. He talked about all sorts of weird things, like the European Commission forcing people to have smaller condoms or square strawberries and things like that. And but the point is that there were a lot of leaks in Brussels, and it was great until I came back to Britain, where official secrecy, the war of official secrecy, was much greater from the paradise really to a very heavy scene back in Britain.
I mean, there's a point to be made here because and I'm not being facile here, but the role of a journalist and the role of an intelligence gatherer aren't that sort of far apart. But as a journalist, your job is to expose the secrets.
Yeah. In one way, they're very, very similar. In another way, they're very diametrically opposed, exactly. And, MI6 intelligence services want to get secrets out of foreign countries, mainly foreign countries, and keep them secret and pass them on secretly to their own government, whereas journalists want to get secrets but publish them. So there are a kind of other side of the same coin, you could argue, absolutely. And maybe you need similar characteristics or temperament, i.e. you've got to be quite a sort of risk taker, really. You've got to be quite extrovert. The kind of personality you need to be a journalist are similar in many respects as to be a spy.
What is it, though, about the British and their love of secrecy, their love to keep things under wraps? I mean, some would say, well, we need to keep things under the Official Secrets Act. You know, the public don't need to know this. You argue that, actually, that's counterproductive.
Well, it is counterproductive. I think, you know, people said it's not an original quote to say that the secrecy was a particularly English disease. The British are really, and they pay for it in Brussels. I'll say that in one second. I think they think, I think one thing, and the similarity with France, actually, but not other countries, not Germany, other countries would have different histories. And that is, they think the state is a force for good, the sort of deference there. So it's not, it makes it more difficult for most journalists well, those journalists actually who are interested in pursuing or getting in the secret world, is that MPs, even members of parliament and ministers, are very deferential to what I call the permanent government, i.e. the security intelligence agencies or the mandarins, the senior civil servants in Whitehall. I think there are similarities in France, actually. But what I learned in Brussels was that everyone else would leak like mad, probably because they resented the British sort of arrogance. And other countries were much more open, and the British were very, very uptight, really, and secretive. And it did not help them. It has not helped the security intelligence agencies, and I say therefore it hasn't helped British national security, because if they say nothing, if MI5 and MI6, the British security intelligence services, say nothing about what they're doing, and they say they can't say anything, you can make all sorts of things up. And the myths are created, and some people therefore said, let's get less secretive, and they are slowly getting less secretive.
But isn't that the problem, that once you get an MP selected to a Privy Council and they get to sit and listen to what's happening in the world of intelligence, they suddenly become all over 007 and think that they're part of the team?
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, there's one outfit called the Intelligence and Security Committee made of hand-picked MPs and members of the House of Lords in Britain. And they meet in private all the time, and they feel flattered that they've been allowed into this ring of secrecy, which they keep themselves. Of course, even their role is meant to be to actually independently scrutinise these agencies, and of course they don't. They get caught up in this ring of secrecy and become part of this sort of that secret establishment, if you like. And it makes for a better life too, of course. If officials don't have to describe or what they're doing and defend themselves in public, of course, that is dangerous, but also makes for an easy life.
And also it means that, people in the intelligence service, there are various products that have wasted huge amounts of money that haven't been called to account.
Well, they've made money, and also the mistakes aren't corrected. I mean, there have been quite a lot of errors. I mean, I know it's very, very difficult, but for example, of all the terror attacks in the West, actually, since 9/11, the vast majority, say 30 out of 40-odd, of the perpetrators, the terrorists, the attackers, have been known to a country's national security intelligence agencies. You can argue it's a good thing. At least this guy doesn't come out of the blue, as it were. But it means that there's some sort of difficulty in following these people, either because of resource problems or because they get their eye off the ball. That's another question, I think, in that they gather up so much data on sort of innocent people, really, because they can't resist it. They can't see the wood from the trees, which is another problem.
Let me take back to 2003 with the invasion of Iraq. You were one of the few journalists to be opposed to this, whilst the government seems to be trying to get everybody else behind, the mission, the war against terror.
Yeah. Well, the frustrating thing then as a journalist is the day after that, certainly week after week in The Guardian, I was writing all these columns saying the Foreign Office and MI6 is split, the Foreign Intelligence Service. The British Foreign Office, but the government lawyers were all against the invasion for all different reasons. But I couldn't name anybody because they were all off the record. So you have to sort of talk about Whitehall officials or intelligence sources have told me, which is not nearly as effective as if you could name somebody. And MPs were seduced by, they had this deference, they were seduced by Tony Blair, of course, and this where they sort of dodgy dossiers where MI6 drafted these the allegations of Saddam Hussein having all these terrible weapons of mass destruction, which proved to be completely untrue. That's the abuse of intelligence, really, for political ends. And that, the frustrating thing there was, of course, a few of us wrote all these pieces attacking the invasion, and that same thing in the consequences, and with especially the domestic security service, Britain's MI5, were saying if you attack Iraq, you'll get more homegrown terrorism. Islamists and so on will be enraged by this, and they'll be made much more militant. And terrorism was always regarded, even before 9/11, as Britain's main security threat. Nothing to do with Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
You're also on the front line when the Chilcot report came out, of course, and that was devastating to Tony Blair's government.
Yes. It was indeed. I mean, the trouble is it went so much. It went on for so long. It was delayed for so long because of the difficulty of Chilcot getting relevant documents out of Whitehall and the Cabinet Office in London. And it was delayed in the end. It was delayed for years. It was delayed in the end because Britain had this referendum, people may remember, in June 2016 on the EU membership. And Chilcot report was published about a week later. And, of course, the whole of the British political scene and debate was dominated by the very surprising referendum result, i.e. Britain should leave the EU. And so it got lost. This devastating report by Chilcot, which really puts the boot into not only MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, for misleading the government, or misleading the public too, for that matter, but also the Ministry of Defence, senior military commanders not speaking truth to power, for example, to the to senior officials and to ministers. And it's a devastating report, which really got lost, and it is remains neglected. It's a wonderful report. It's on the website, and it should be resuscitated in a sense. And people are in danger of not learning the lessons. And of course, when we, after the invasion of Iraq, Britain joined the attacks, the operations in Afghanistan, and of course, as we now know, that led to a lot of deaths, and that was really inefficiently run. There was ignorance about the tribal system in Afghanistan. And then Cameron said, David Cameron, when he was prime minister, said, we can't just get rid of people by dropping bombs of 15,000 feet. And very soon afterwards, of course, he, with other NATO countries, bombed Libya. And what happened there? There's complete mayhem, and the consequences there are still, of course, very bad, because you get divided Libya and all sorts of problems, including refugees coming across the Mediterranean. I mean, bombing, and the consequences are still with us, and they've been devastating and very, very, very bad.
You've written for 50 years, nearly 50 years, for one paper, The Guardian, and you currently handle their blogs as well. Would you think any other paper would have let you go with such free rein, if you like, and tackle those subjects?
No, probably not. I think that, it's all relative. I think The Guardian and maybe The Observer too, now owned by The Guardian, has encouraged, and the editors encourage you to go for stories which other people didn't have, and go for it and attacking official secrecy, actually. I had good editors, first Peter Preston, then Alan Rusbridger, who encouraged journalists to do this. We were the first to, for example, also probably some of the WikiLeaks, Julian Assange's leaked documents about America's role in Iraq, also in Afghanistan. So basically, I think The Guardian was special in that case, and other papers, and especially the BBC too, I have to say, were sort of reluctant to actually delve and question as much as we were encouraged to by our editors in The Guardian.
There's been some lighter moments as well, though. I'm thinking about, what was it, 6 weeks you spent in Australia covering the Spycatcher?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, one thing that belatedly security intelligence services learned is that the Official Secrets Act and the obsession with secrecy, even covering historical matters, was actually rebounded, were counterproductive. Peter Wright, who was a former MI5 officer, living in Australia at the time, and he wanted to publish his memoirs called Spycatcher. So I published a couple of stories about the allegations he had made about Britain MI5 bugging and burgling across Whitehall and all that kind of stuff. And Margaret Thatcher at the time insisted that he should be tried for breach of confidentiality. So we were sent by our editors, some of us, one or two of us, to Sydney for about 6 weeks covering this trial, which was great in a way, partly because the Australian defence, against the British prosecutors, really made fun of what they call, they love the pommy bashing, the British obsession with secrecy, especially as the evidence says that the other people were allowed to write about this in the past. And there was a famous case, and a judge too in Sydney, really loved to tease and take the mickey really out of the British establishment. So it was a great sort of, it's a great time for a British journalist in Sydney, and showing that, the rest of the world did not, including white Commonwealth countries, I can put it that way, did not sympathise with the British obsession with the secrecy of the mother country, if you like.
Why did you decide then that it was time to put this all together in a book? Do you think the time is ready for this sort of book? As we become, as you said, there's a war on terror, there's talk after the attacks in London, which must have more security and more secrecy, and the ordinary people don't need to know about this.
We certainly need good intelligence services, but to make them more efficient, I think they should be, one, more open. They should learn from the problems and the mistakes of the past, and there should be much more scrutiny, much more effective and credible scrutiny, because after all, and the laws, that's the other point, increasing developments in surveillance technology with artificial intelligence, with algorithms and all that. Laws cannot control the security intelligence agencies with their vast data banks and surveillance technologies, as I say, there, which they have. And that is a dangerous situation which people are not accepting. So basically, if you want to put these people to be really accountable, it's up to the ethos, the internal ethos and culture, if you like, of these organizations, as well as laws, which, as I say, cannot keep up. Laws cannot keep up with developments in surveillance technology, which the tech companies like Google and so on admit as well. They sort of say, no point in governments regulating us, because technology is so much far advanced, they can't control it properly. Well, if governments can't, certainly the public can't, and members of parliament can't either. So for all those reasons, I think it's very timely now to discuss this and have a proper debate about how we subject these secretive agencies to constructively to independent scrutiny.
The book is called The State of Secrecy, Spies and the Media in Britain. It comes out on the 30th of March via IB Taurus. It's by Richard Norton Taylor. Richard, you were described, as I said before, as a long-term thorn in the side of the Italian establishment. You must still be relatively pleased about that comment.
Well, it was quite flattering in a way, I suppose, yes. That was some time ago. And you never know, of course. This person who is a former DCHQ official said that some time ago. And, of course, if I knew that they were saying that at the time, I would be even more pleased, and maybe that would lead to sort of kind of arrogance. They didn't want to encourage people like me to pursue them and find out what they're getting up to. But yeah, sure, it is quite. Well, I think, you know, some of us, a few of us, were pursuing this, not very many. It's very frustrating to spend a lot of time, many years, sort of battering your head, really, against, or your professional head, at least, against this wall of official secrecy. Yeah. But it's rewarding. It has been rewarding, and it's only been entertaining. I think in the end of the day, I hope, and privately, security intelligence people admit that they had to be. They were far too secretive. They still are too secretive. So in that sense, you're doing something, you're writing, you're pursuing things which they privately, members of security intelligence agencies, privately admit, or at least the most enlightened ones of them, agree should be done, and they should be subjected to more independent scrutiny.
The book is called The State of Secrecy, Spies and the Media in Britain. It's by Richard Norton Taylor. Richard, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.